All right, all right. We're going to get started. Just get to your seats. Okay. Good evening, everyone. My name is Ben Esposito, and I'm the treasurer of the Stanford College Republicans. I want to welcome everyone, of course, everyone here tonight, but especially our guest, Dinesh D'Souza. Yay! You know, we have worked incredibly hard against persistent obstacles to make this event happen, and frankly, I'm very glad to be standing here tonight. As most of you know, the Stanford College Republicans works to promote conservative ideals and policies right here at Stanford. We have held tabling events promoting due process, the right to life, and the failings of socialism. This is not an easy task on this college campus. Given all of the resistance from a rogue student government that was prepared to violate its own constitution to stop us from hosting Mr. D'Souza, again, the fact that I'm standing here, it is incredible. It feels surreal. But fortunately, for the moment, Stanford can still live up to its motto, its own motto, as the place where the wind of freedom blows. Now I know that many of us here tonight are worried that we are at an inflection point in our history. You know, increasing members of the Democratic Party embrace socialism over capitalism, arbitrary process over due process, personal truth over absolute truth, and thought suppression over free speech. It is therefore not very surprising to me that we are at one of the most polarizing times in our country's history. Our rights and liberties cannot be taken for granted. In 1787, at the close of the Constitutional Convention, a woman asked Ben Franklin what sort of government the framers had decided on. He told her, "A republic, if you can keep it." It was obvious to Ben Franklin over 230 years ago, just as it is obvious to us many of today, that our traditions of free speech and due process cannot survive without individuals who are willing to defend them. As Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas once summarized very well the importance of defending our fundamental ideals, he said that having the right answer is often the least difficult problem. Having the courage to assert that answer and stand firm in the face of the constant winds of protest and criticism is often much more difficult. You had better not engage in serious debate or discussion unless you are willing to endure attacks that range from mere hostile bluster to libel. I hope that all of you who have come to this event this evening, especially those of you seeking a different perspective, recognize the importance of maintaining the American traditions of free, open, and respectful discourse. To achieve this, we have designed a lengthy Q&A session after Dinesh's talk. We would also like to thank the donors, alumni, and partners that have contributed their time and money for this event, who have not only offered to donate money, but who also directly reached out to Stanford to help ensure that this school remains an environment respecting of free speech. Thank you. Moreover, we would like to extend a big thank you to the Young Americas Foundation. YAF has been on the front lines of bringing conservative ideas to college campuses for decades. And we are grateful for their never-ending commitment to helping us turn Stanford into a marketplace of ideas. So again, thank you. The generous anonymous sponsors of this lecture asked that we share the following statement explaining the importance of free speech and why it is important that you hear from Dinesh tonight. Here's their statement. Students deserve to receive an education based on unbiased facts, not revisionist history. Sadly, too few students today benefit from a robust understanding of the ideas and events that shape our world, because too few schools offer perspectives that challenge the liberal worldview. This is not education, it's indoctrination, and it's not just unfair to students, it's dangerous. It is alarming that today's young people are taught to believe that freedom, the great protector against tyranny, should be forfeited in the pursuit of progressive ideals. We are sponsoring this lecture, part of D'Souza's 10 campus tour, to give you the opportunity to consider ideas that may not be taught or tolerated on your campus. We are pleased to help conservative groups like YAF and Dinesh reach thousands of young people to inspire you to pursue knowledge, challenge misinformation, and advance freedom and prosperity for all. May tonight's lecture inspire you to never stop seeking out new viewpoints. So thank you. Now let me introduce our speaker tonight, Dinesh D'Souza. Dinesh D'Souza, born in Mumbai, India, first came to the US as an exchange student. He graduated from Dartmouth College, Phi Beta Kappa, has been a policy advisor in the Reagan administration, a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, and a fellow at the Hoover Institution right here at Stanford. He is the author of several national best-selling books and has directed numerous documentaries, most recently, Death of a Nation. We're going to watch a short video right now, and then Mr. D'Souza will speak.
He's a man of a searching and versatile intellect. He is a man who can bridge cultures and understands history and scholarship and politics and theology and philosophy.
My guest this week is an author, a filmmaker, a former policy advisor to Ronald Reagan,
Mr. Dinesh D'Souza.
This American dream is a dream not just of economic opportunity or success, but it's ultimately a dream where you can be the architect of your own destiny.
I grew up in a different world, actually a world without America. And although I grew up without a phone, without television, without hot water, we had a car, but if you looked down the floor of our car, you could see the ground.
He's been described as an influential conservative thinker. He's a best-selling author, political commentator, and filmmaker.
The great man, Dinesh D'Souza, a patriotic man.
No longer would I say that I live in a rarefied world of intellectual debate. I've seen the upside of America, and I've seen the downside of America. But at the end of the day, I wouldn't trade the United States for any other country. At the end of the day, my enthusiasm for American government may have dimmed, but my enthusiasm for this country burns brighter than ever. Thank you very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, Dinesh D'Souza.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Wow. I am very honored and thrilled to be here. I've spoken over the years maybe four times at Stanford University. The event that I remember the best was, several years ago now, where in Memorial Auditorium I debated the Reverend Jesse Jackson. And I want to mention that because I was thinking about that in the context of our divided society, and the reason why debates on campuses like this one become so acrimonious, so out of control. And I was remembering that when the Reverend Jackson and I were up on the podium, we were debating, is America a racist society? And I won't go into the merits of the arguments. I was arguing that racism in America used to be systemic, but is now episodic. The Reverend Jackson was arguing that racism has gone underground and is covert, but no less present than ever. But that's not the part of it that interested me, because as I was listening to this debate, participating in it, I looked at the Reverend Jackson and it hit me that he and I are exactly the same color. If we were to put our hands up side by side, they'd match. And I thought to myself, we're both intelligent people, we're in the same country, and we're looking at the same facts. So how is it possible for two people to disagree so profoundly about the same data? It's kind of like if you have two guys sitting in a restaurant, they see an accident, but they give radically different, incommensurable accounts of it. How is that actually possible? And then it occurred to me that the reason, perhaps, for our difference of perspective is that our angle of perception was completely different. I am an immigrant from India, and I bring to America what can be called the immigrant perspective, the perspective of somebody who is an insider. I've lived here most of my life, but grew up in another culture and has, in that sense, a different angle of vision. Now, the Reverend Jesse Jackson is a leader of, you may say, an indigenous minority. By indigenous, I mean simply a minority that's been in America for a really long time. And the immigrant perspective and the indigenous minority perspective are not the same. Why? Because I thought to myself, the immigrant is bringing to America what can be called a historical or comparative perspective. If somebody says, is America a racist society, the first question in my mind is, compared to what? But that's not how the Reverend Jackson saw the matter at all. He wasn't saying that America is more racist than some other country. He was using what can be called a utopian standard. He was measuring America according to a certain, you may say, standard of perfection, the Garden of Eden, and using this utopian or idealistic standard, he found that America fell woefully short. And so the reason for our differences wasn't that he was lying or I was lying, but rather that we were using a different compass, a different standard of measurement. That's worth keeping in mind tonight, because I think we're going to get into some pretty controversial issues. But if we do disagree about them, let's try to think about why we do. What are the compasses that we're bringing, the presumptions to the debate? I want to talk very briefly about three things, because I think these are actually three of the sources of our cultural divide. I'm going to speak briefly about social justice. I'm going to speak briefly about identity, focusing a little bit on the issue of the wall. And then I'm going to spend most of my talk speaking about racism and fascism. So let me begin with the issue of the wall. That was on the poster. You know, I think to myself as I walk around Palo Alto, and I know the Palo Alto very well. I was for 8 years a research fellow at the Hoover Institution, so I know the community. And on the face of it, it's a very open community. No walls. You can just walk right onto the campus and feel comfortable. You can sip your latte and so on. Where are the walls? This horrible Trump, he wants to build a wall. And then it occurred to me that Stanford actually has a wall. And it's a much bigger wall than any wall that Trump wants to build. And this wall is actually organized or controlled by the admissions office. It is the wall of admission to an elite community. And this wall is so tall and so opaque that, to my knowledge, in the entire history of the university, no one has ever scaled a wall. Think about it. Think of what it means to scale a wall. What it would mean at Stanford is for someone to sneak into Stanford, take classes for 4 years, and make off with a Stanford degree. Has anyone, to your knowledge, ever done that? No. And that means that Stanford, you, ruthlessly enforced this wall against outsiders. Your community decides who gets to be a member, and you will not allow any intruders, you will not allow any degree of compassion to allow someone to come in and claim the same degree that you and your parents are demanding of you, that's going to give you an advantage in the race of life over all those other people on the other side of the wall. And I think if you were honest, you would admit that this is true. And the only point I want to make in connection with the wall is that every community has this right. America has the right to say who gets to be a member of this society. And once America decides that democratically through laws, its job then is to be fair to the citizens and to non-citizens. I'm an example of somebody who had to come to America by standing in a very long line. I happen to come from a country very far away. So there's no question of swimming across the Rio Grande or tunneling my way under a fence. There's no way to get here that way. You have to stand in line. And so fairness is also fairness between the immigrant across the border and the immigrant in Bombay, India. You have to have the same rules apply to all of us. So that's the moral case for a wall. The moral case for a wall is simply the right of a community to decide democratically who gets to be a new member. And I think if you extend this right to Stanford, which you undoubtedly do, it's very difficult to say it should not belong to America. Let me now pivot to a deeper topic I want to address in a little more depth, social justice. What is the social justice argument all about? As I understand it, the social justice argument is quite new. In the 20th century, the century when I was in college, the debate was between capitalism and socialism, and that debate was really about which system was more efficient in creating wealth. And that argument was actually settled. One system won, capitalism won, and many people thought, that's it, socialism is done. Socialism will go away. Why? Because for Marx, as for Adam Smith, the issue of creating abundance was decisive. And capitalism seemed to have won on that critical score. But although capitalism won the economic debate, it never won the moral debate. And the moral debate is not about which system creates wealth. The moral debate is over how that wealth is distributed. What is a just allocation of that wealth? And interestingly, even if you go right back to Adam Smith, you don't find the moral defense of capitalism. Actually, Adam Smith's defense of capitalism is sort of indirect. In other words, the entrepreneur, by pursuing his or her selfish interests through the invisible hand of competition, nevertheless advances the material welfare of society. It's a very half-hearted defense. And so I want to take the bull by the horns and ask, on what basis can we decide that the allocations of capitalism are just? Let's take an actual example of what I mean. Here in Palo Alto, there's a Ritz-Carlton, there's a Westin. Now imagine a guy who is a valet parking cars at the Ritz-Carlton here in Palo Alto. And this guy is paid, let's say, $15 an hour. And let's say that he works 10 hours a day, so he makes 150 bucks. And this guy is now thinking to myself, in those 10 hours, how many cars did I park? Well, I parked, let's say, 100 cars. And how much does the Ritz-Carlton charge for someone to park their car? $30. So how much should the Ritz-Carlton make as a result of me parking those 100 cars? $3,000. And how much was I paid out of that $3,000? $150. 3,000 minus 150 gives $2,850. Who gets that? So from the valet's point of view, this is a very unjust system because I'm doing the work and some other guy is taking the cash. And this argument about the injustice of capitalism is actually anchored in, I think, a rather interesting argument that was made by Marx himself. Marx basically said that when you have a business, an enterprise, there are two groups of people that are involved in making this enterprise go. There's capital, the capitalist, and there's labor. So the capitalist provides what? Capital. And capital, Marx says, has a cost, and that's called interest. So part of the cost of the business is to pay interest on the capital. And then Marx says there are other costs. There's rent, there's equipment, there's machinery, there's this, there's insurance, there's this, there's that. Add up all the costs, including the cost of paying labor, and you get total cost. That's the total cost of running a business. And Marx says, now you might expect that the product would be sold for that. But in fact, the capitalist will sell the product for the highest that the market will bear, as much as he can sell it for. And so there's a big difference between the revenue generated by the sales and the cost. And that difference Marx calls surplus value. We call it profit. And Marx's question, quite a profound question, who gets that? Now, Marx's assumption is that that belongs 100% to labor. Why? Because labor made the goods. The capitalist supplied nothing more than the money, which has already been recompensed through interest. My view is that this description, convincing as it is on first glance, is a completely false representation of how businesses actually run. Consider for a moment the capitalist. In America today, the vast majority of capitalists supply a lot of things, but the one thing they do not supply is capital. Did Steve Jobs actually put up all the capital for Apple? No, he went to a bank. The bank supplied the capital. And this is true of Gates and everyone down the list. The bottom line of it, the capitalist supplies three things that Marx completely ignores that are actually of far greater value than capital and actually entitle the capitalist to a share of the profit, but Marx, in a sense, submerges these three factors completely. First, the capitalist has the idea for the business. Without the idea, there's no business. Labor doesn't think of the idea, the capitalist does. It's his or her idea. They do it. Second, the capitalist organizes the business. Here you have this valet, he goes, I park the cars, I need all the money. The truth of it is, the reason you're getting $30 to park a car is you're at the Ritz-Carlton. Somebody built the Ritz-Carlton, somebody thought of it, somebody paid all the capital costs, somebody took out the insurance. You didn't think of that. If you come to my house and want to park my car, I'll pay you 50 cents. So the reason that you're getting $30 is not because of you. It's not your labor that's worth $30. It's the resort that's worth $30. And you didn't create that. So the capitalist has the idea for it, he organizes it, and third, he takes all the risk. Very important factor. The capitalist gets paid at the end. If the business has a bad quarter, Steve Jobs can't go, or the current Tim Cook can't go to Apple and say, sorry guys, I'm not gonna pay you for 6 months. It's looking bad for us this half of the year. No, he has to pay them anyway. So labor is trading a fixed wage for security. But the entrepreneur is taking the risk that he might get nothing out of it, and he could even lose money. So the truth of the matter is that in fairly assessing the just rewards of capitalism, you have to match what the entrepreneur actually contributes. And to say it's just capital, it seems to me, is a gross misunderstanding how business is actually conducted in the United States and all around the world. Wow, I guess I'm getting warmed up. Now, the decisive issues that have made us crazy in the last 2 years, but longer than that, the reason that we have not had in this country any real debate about any issue, not even immigration, not even the court, not even taxes, not even North Korea, nothing. Why? Because we have had a swirling current of accusation aimed, of course, specifically at Trump, but more broadly against Republicans and conservatives. And this is the invective that basically says that Trump and his Trumpsters are... They're here. The charge of racism and the charge of fascism. Now, let's be fair. These are the two most incendiary accusations that you can make. You're a racist. You're a fascist. And they carry consequences, because if they're true, let's say Trump is a racist and he is a fascist, then you could argue that, well, Trump is like Hitler circa 1933. If Trump is like Hitler circa 1933, then we don't have to debate with him. We don't have to accept the result of the election. We would be justified in mobilizing whatever degree of force is necessary to try to overthrow him, because look at the dire consequences of letting Hitler do what he did after 1933. So it's very important whether or not these original premises are actually correct, are actually true. Now, for me to address this topic is a little bit strange. And it's a little bit strange for the following reason. Through my research, I find that on these basic topics, like fascism, many things that people, intelligent people, know to be true are not true. And one question I've actually thought a lot about is, how does that actually happen? If you take a college like Stanford, how could it be that a student or even a professor who studies a topic can know something about it that is not true? Let me suggest how I think that can happen. First of all, let's take a premise. And I'm going to use the premise that fascism is on the right. Fascism is on the right. Now, this is a very important premise for the left, because if fascism were not on the right, you couldn't call Trump a fascist. If fascism were on the left, it would make no sense to call Trump a fascist. You need the idea that fascism is on the right to get away with that charge. And so I ask you the question, how do we know that fascism is on the right? How do we know that? I will submit to you that prior to 1945, nobody thought that. Prior to 1945, the fascists and the anti-fascists all thought fascism was on the left. FDR knew that fascism was on the left. And yet after World War II, we got this new idea that fascism is on the right. So how can someone know this when no one at the time thought so? The way this works is something like this. A professor at the Tulane or Stanford History Department will write a book, a controversial book, a polemic, Fascism is on the Right. His or her colleagues, who are sympathetic ideologically, go, great book, marvelous, breakthrough book. Pretty soon, favorable review in the New York Review of Books. Pretty soon, the guy's being interviewed on NPR. Michael Moore comes rolling in to do a documentary. Suddenly, people are putting it up on Wikipedia. It's on the History Channel. So here's what I mean. The intelligent person, if you ask them, is fascism on the left or the right? They go, oh, fascism's obviously on the right. How do you know? Well, you know, I was in Barnes & Noble. I thought I saw something. My professor said something about it. I saw something on the History Channel. There it was on NPR. I type it into Wikipedia. Now, you don't realize this is the same intellectual bullet ricocheting from one wall to the other wall and coming back at you, but because you're observing the phenomenon in different manifestations, each one corroborates the other. Oh, wow, it has to be true. It has to be true. And what I want to do today is challenge these assumptions. It's a very hard thing to do. And the way I'm going to do it, focusing on racism and fascism, is what I call the crushing fact. The crushing fact. And I'm going to try to unleash a half dozen of these before I open the door to questions. The advantage of the crushing fact is, A, it's checkable. And that's the beauty of us living today. Whip out your phone, check it out. If what I say is true, then ask yourself if the premise can be sustained any longer. It's checkable. The second thing about the crushing fact is that we all are entitled to our own interpretations and opinions, but we're not entitled to our own facts. So facts have that ability to settle an argument. And there's a certain kind of raw beauty to that. So I want to talk briefly about fascism first, and then I'm going to talk about racism. And I'm going to try to unfurl these facts. And remember, these facts, by the way, are causing quite a scandal on social media. If you follow my social media, there's a fellow at Princeton. I call him a fake historian. But anyway, he's rounded up 124 historians to rail against these facts. Think of how powerful these facts are. Not one of them can be overturned, even though 124 professionals are trying every day. All right, let's talk about fascism. Now, one thing about fascism that's very interesting, I think, is that even though we use the word a lot, no one can really say what it means. You're a fascist. And this is very important because the actual use of the term, whenever it's used in conventional debate, if you just think about it for a moment, you realize that that can't be what it means. Trump is a fascist because he's an ultra-nationalist. I think I saw Bill Maher the other day. Trump wants to make America great again, just like Hitler wanted to make Germany great again. This is big thinker Bill Maher. Now, I ask you, if nationalism is essentially the defining feature of fascism, was Nelson Mandela a fascist? He was a nationalist. Was Mahatma Gandhi a fascist? He was a nationalist. What about Winston Churchill? He was a nationalist. So was de Gaulle, and so was Abraham Lincoln, and so were all the anti-colonial leaders, Nkrumah in Ghana, Fidel Castro, all these people fascists? Obviously not. Talk sense. Obviously, we need a better understanding of what fascism really is. So fascism, one way to understand a phenomenon is to look at what Nietzsche calls the genealogy of it. How did we get it? How did it start? That'll give you a clue as to what it is. Now, the leading fascist, the founder of fascism, the first fascist regime in the world, not Adolf Hitler, Mussolini. Mussolini was actually Hitler's model. And the very interesting thing is that Mussolini was a Marxist. He was the editor of the socialist newspaper in Italy called Avanti. He knew that he was on the left. In fact, everybody knew he was on the left. Lenin was one of his friends. When Mussolini started the first fascist party, Lenin sent him a telegram of congratulations. Why? To a fellow socialist revolutionary, V.I. Lenin. Now, at that time, there was a huge debate going on in the West over what's called the crisis of Marxism. And the crisis of Marxism, very simple. Marx had predicted that there would be proletarian revolutions in all the industrialized countries, which did not occur. And the question was, why not? The Marxists had to figure out, what did Marx get wrong? And Mussolini, having fought in World War I, made this observation. He said, you know, I noticed that the socialists in France all fought for France. I noticed the socialists in Britain all fought for Britain. And in Germany, the same thing. So, he says, class is not the only basis of worker solidarity. There's another factor that we've ignored, and that is the factor of nationalism. In other words, what we need is to marry nationalism to socialism for the first time, creating a new thing. Let's call it National Socialism. And this is the actual origin of fascism. It's the marriage of nationalism and socialism. And that's why Hitler's party was called, you already know, the National Socialist German Workers' Party. Now, this fascism was very attractive to progressives in the United States. Progressives in the United States were mesmerized by fascism, both in Italy and in Germany. And not only was there a traffic from America to fascism, in other words, Mussolini was sending members of his brain trust to Rome to study Italian fascism. He wanted to bring it here. He saw fascism as more progressive than the New Deal. I'm sorry, I meant FDR. Franklin D. Roosevelt was sending members of his brain trust to Mussolini's Rome. But it's also true that the fascists, for their part, were deriving and drawing on ideas from the United States. This is not known. And I want to give a single example, which I've dramatized in my movie, Death of a Nation. You'll see it. But if you see it, I would forgive you for being incredulous, because the scene that you see does not appear, to my knowledge, in any high school or college textbook. And yet, it is a fact. It's occurred. I have the documents. It's corroborated by mainstream historians, notably James Whitman at Yale. So the scene that you see in the movie is this. Leading members of Nazi Germany, 1935, are in a room, and they're drafting the so-called Nuremberg Laws. And the Nuremberg Laws are the laws that make Jews into second-class citizens. And they do three things. They segregate Jews into ghettos, they forbid intermarriage between Jews and other Germans, and they condone confiscation of Jewish property, in other words, state-sponsored discrimination against Jews. And the Nazis are sitting there, and they basically say, we want to make these laws, but there's no international precedent for them. Nobody has done this kind of thing. And then one of the Nazis who had studied in the United States says, actually, gentlemen, you're wrong. Somebody has beaten us to the punch. The Democratic Party in the United States has laws that do all the three things that we want. The Jim Crow laws of the American South have segregation. There are anti-miscegenation laws outlawing intermarriage, and they condone state-sponsored discrimination. All we have to do is take the laws of the Democratic Party, cross out the word black, write in the word Jew, and we are home free. What am I saying here? I'm not saying that the Nazis got a parallel idea. I'm saying the actual Nazis had in their hands the blueprints of the democratic laws and used it to make the Nuremberg Laws, and this fact has been completely suppressed in progressive historiography in the United States. Now, I said that the Nazis were talking about the democratic laws, and you might be like, democratic laws? Aren't you talking about the Southern laws? See, the Nazis actually knew something that we don't know. Namely, every segregation law in the United States from the 1880s to the 1950s was passed by a democratic legislature, signed by a democratic governor, enforced by democratic officials, and there is not a single exception to this rule. Once again, if you rush back to your political science textbook, this fact will be downplayed, if not omitted. Why? And now we come to a little bit of the bigger picture here. The bigger picture here is that what we call history is progressive history. And we shouldn't be naive about this. The progressives themselves were fighting against earlier forms of history. And so the progressives were a kind of, you may say, intellectual militant movement that overthrew what came before them. And then in taking power, their power was in writing the history books, and that meant that they could spin the narrative and suppress facts inconvenient to their side. It's been done from the beginning of history. We should hardly be surprised it's being done now. I mentioned segregation. I want to pull back and say just a word about slavery. Because when I speak on campus, it's not atypical where I'll tell students, the Democratic Party was the party of slavery. And I say it so matter-of-factly that students are a little puzzled because they've always heard slavery was done by the white man or by America. And I say, look, America didn't do anything. Some Americans did it, and other Americans stopped them. We need to distinguish who did it. And who did it was the Democratic Party in the North and the South. That's the key. Because the whole idea of knocking Confederate monuments is essentially a strategic stage tactic to fool you into thinking that the slavery debate was North-South. But Abraham Lincoln knew better. In fact, Abraham Lincoln, when he identified what he called the four horsemen of the apocalypse, the four bad guys of slavery, he mentioned Roger Taney, who wrote the Dred Scott decision. He was a Southerner. He's actually from Maryland, but the South. And then Lincoln mentions Franklin Pierce, the former president from New Hampshire, Northern Democrat, James Buchanan from Pennsylvania, Northern Democrat, and Stephen Douglas, Lincoln's supreme antagonist from Illinois, Northern Democrat. So three of the four pro-slavery champions are Northerners. And so inevitably, when I tell students this, the following happens. some, you know, professor of romance languages at Bowdoin College will stand up. Mr. D'Souza, you are misleading the audience. You are misleading the audience by pointing a finger of blame solely at one party, whereas we all know there was plenty of blame to go around. Very interesting statement. First of all, it retreats from the position that the Republicans are the bad guys. It now tries, sort of with a squid-like cloud of obfuscation, to spread the blame so broadly that no one really knows what's going on. So it's really important at this time to unfurl what I call the crushing fact. The crushing fact is the fact that settles the argument at one blow. And so this is the time for me to point out that in 1860, which was the year before the Civil War, no Republican owned a slave. Think about this for a moment. I'm not saying that no Republican leader owned a slave. I'm saying no Republican in the United States owned a slave. And if what I say is true, very important if, it's kind of like, reminds me of the atheist who read the Bible for the first time. He read it cover to cover, and at the end he made a single notation in the margin, important if true. Important if true. And that applies to my statement. Important if true. Important if true. But the beauty of the statement, it is a scientific statement in the sense that Karl Popper intended it, namely, it is vulnerable, naked to refutation. All you have to do is give me the name of one Republican who owned a slave, and I would have to take it back. And yet, from the time I made this statement well over 2 years ago, not a single valid counterexample has surfaced. Several months ago, I got an email from a demographer at the University of Michigan. He goes, Dinesh, I've been working this. I gotcha. Ulysses S. Grant inherited a slave, a solitary slave, admittedly, on his wife's side. And I said, well, that is an impressive riposte, but I need to point out to you that at the time this occurred, Ulysses S. Grant was a Democrat. He became a Republican later. So, what am I getting at? What I'm getting at is we have a really strange phenomenon. If you look at what's going on now, you have Democrats on the left pointing the finger of racism at the very people who fought racism from the beginning of this country's history, while suppressing the fact that the actual racism came from their party. In other words, this is not just about slavery. The Democrats were the party of slavery, of segregation, of founding the Ku Klux Klan, of reviving the Ku Klux Klan, and of racial terrorism, and of opposition to the civil rights movement of the 1960s. The opposition to the civil rights movement, the Civil Rights Act of 64, the Voting Rights Act of 65, the Fair Housing Bill of 68, came mainly from the Democratic Party, and that's a fact. Now, faced with this crushing history, we have a puzzle. I mean, first of all, the very guys who have poisoned the waters are now showing up pretending to be the water commissioner. They did it. They've never admitted it. They've never apologized for it. They haven't paid one penny of restitution for it. And yet they're presumed to lecture the rest of us, who are completely innocent on this score, of being the real culprits. I mean, this is really funny. My wife, Debbie, who's a Latina, her father's Venezuelan, her mom's Mexican, and we're Dartmouth, East Indian and Latina, and you have a bunch of white guys screaming at us, racist. I mean, what is this, Saturday Night Live? And this is at an Ivy League college. Now, I do want to address, before I circle back and open the door to questions, I want to address one final point, because this is key. Very important point for the left, and it is the idea that the Democrats have a get-out-of-jail-free card. Namely, according to them, the two parties switched sides. They switched. Basically, the Republicans became Democrats, and the Democrats became Republicans. Now, for anyone who actually knows anything about American history, this is akin to saying, you know, guys, There was a time, a little far back, maybe in the 1960s, when the cops all decided to become criminals. And the criminals all decided to become cops. They switched sides. And you'd be inherently like, how the hell would that happen? What kind of sense does that make? What kind of idiot statement is that? But no, this is not an idiot statement. The cause is pressed seriously that the parties switched. And the main thrust of the argument is that the racist Dixiecrats, we have to define our terms, a Dixiecrat here is a member of the Dixiecrat Party, or somebody who voted against the civil rights laws of the 60s, the racist Dixiecrats all became Republicans. If true, this would vindicate the idea that the Democrats may have once been the bad guys, but now the bad guys have sort of moved over. But the beauty, again, of this kind of statement is the fact that it's empirical. It's not one of those, who's to say what's true? No, all you have to do is whip out your phone and type in the word Dixiecrat, and about 150 names will come up. And then you start to count. How many of the racist Dixiecrats became Republicans? And the correct answer, which I will tell you now, is 2. In the House, one guy, Albert Watson. In the Senate, one guy, Strom Thurmond. And all the other racist Dixiecrats lived and died in the Democratic Party. They're lionized to this day. There are buildings in Washington, D.C. named after them. And so this notion of a party switch is a big lie. If you believe in the party switch, all this stuff going on, Ralph Northam in his KKK outfit, his wife handing out cotton to black students, you'd be like, what? I thought this was all in the Republican Party. This doesn't make any sense to me. But if you've been listening to me, it makes perfect sense. It makes perfect sense because the racists stayed in the Democratic Party. They always did. Their tactics shifted over the years. Now, where does this leave us today? I think where it leaves us today is that, very sadly, some of these terrible things from history, bigotry, a fascist streak, we still have it in America. But where is it coming from? People say, you know, Trump's a fascist. He hates democracy. He won't tolerate dissent. I'm thinking, first of all, if Trump is a fascist and he won't tolerate dissent, how come you're dissenting? Trump is bashed on every platform, every minute of every day. He's bashed on the Emmys. He's bashed in Broadway shows are interrupted to bash Trump. Now, quite frankly, if this was Mussolini, he would send in a bunch of goons and beat those guys up, and that would be the end of that. That's how dictators actually behave. The other day, I saw the actress Cher complaining about Trump. She goes, he beat the hell out of me on Twitter. On Twitter. A real fascist would have beaten the hell out of her, period. Now, that being said, there is a streak of bullying and intimidation and intolerance. But I would argue, simple empirical evidence shows it's coming from the left. It's coming from the left. We know it. Now, never feel sorry for a guy like me, because I enjoy it. This kind of craziness, when I experience it, it's fun. You're actually making my day. But the people I really feel sorry for is the ordinary student. The ordinary student who feels like I can't speak my mind because there is this crushing, bullying, kind of intellectual gangsterism around me that doesn't allow me to think freely, it doesn't allow me to speak freely. And what it does is it takes the label of hate speech. By the way, the Democratic Party is officially the party of hate speech. They invented hate speech. And they take this label of hate speech and they foist it on people who are not doing any hate. I mean, if you think about it, the left that wanted to ban my lecture describe what I've just been telling you for the last 45 minutes as hate speech. To them, this speech does not belong at Stanford. Notice my reading of it, that the reason they say that is none of them can counter a single fact I raise. If they could, they'd stand up and do it. And the same with these 124 historians. Oh, your article appeared in Breitbart. That makes you a fool. I'm like, my article may have appeared in Breitbart, but it's an excerpt from my book. It doesn't matter what website it appeared on. Let's see if you can question. My article was about the three things that Hitler got from the Democratic Party. You think this is explosive stuff? If you could refute it, you'd be all over the content. Oh, Dinesh, why are you publishing in Breitbart? As if that's what discredits the article. Look, this is a very elite campus. You're a very smart group of students. You deserve better. But intellectual freedom means fighting against the people who are blocking you from being able to think for yourself. I submit at the end of the day, that's not Dinesh D'Souza who comes once in a while to speak on a Monday, leave on a Tuesday. That's the bullying elements who are around you every day, who will make your life hell if you want to be nothing more than what you should be, which is in fact an intellectually liberated you. Thank you very much.
So it's time for Q&A. We're going to ask everyone to go around for if you have a question for Dinesh. Rules for Q&A, no long expositions. Don't say like a long-winded question sort of thing. And just ask a question at the end of what you're saying. Yeah. You can line up behind Tristan.
I also think, guys, as a rule of thumb, just to make this more fun, it would be nice to start with some questions that are hostile. So let me suggest that if you have a hostile question, you can kind of mosey your way to the front.
Hello, sir. My name is Jason Spires. I'm a current Stanford student, and I'm getting ready to start up the Libertarian chapter here on campus. Anybody wants to join, please find me. My question comes that I seen that this was supposed to be the moral defense to build the wall. And we can argue, rather, we need to secure our borders and stop immigrants from coming in. But is the question really about using eminent domain to take people's private property to build a wall? Or is it about finding a way to sustain our border to stop people from being able to scale it? Like you said, Stanford has found a way to prevent intruders without a physical wall. Shouldn't the US aspire to do just as good as Stanford is?
I take your question to be asking not a question about whether we need a wall, but what kind of a wall. And I'm using the term wall here metaphorically. You seem to agree. This reminds me a little bit, by the way, of Frost's poem, Mending Wall. Because in Mending Wall, you've got a neighbor who's railing against his neighbor for building a wall, right? But while he's railing on the neighbor for building a wall, he never claims the right to go into his neighbor's property. He never claims the right to take his neighbor's stuff. He accepts the need for a wall. He just doesn't like the wall. He thinks it could be done a different way. And I agree with you. Let me suggest this way. If you have a better suggestion for how to actually enforce security on the southern border, let's just say through a combination of various techniques, you should propose it. I think, see, the problem is these topics are never debated. They're never debated. Right now, the debate is frozen between the wall or, in effect, porous borders. It's a very bad debate. We should actually be debating what is the best way to enforce security on the southern border. And I'm not dogmatic about that. I'm open to all kinds of ideas. I think Trump's point in emphasizing the wall is simply this, that for now 30 years, there are these bogus debates about fixing immigration and things like, what do we do with all the illegals who are in America and so on? None of those problems can be seriously considered until a country has a real border. Now, again, you seem to agree there should be a border, there's just a better way to do it.
Domain to take citizens' private property.
Ever?
And your analogy, and I'm not being rude, I admire what you're doing, but your analogy is flawed because the neighbor building the wall, in order for your analogy to work, the neighbor would have to step over my property line, take my property, and try to build that wall on my property. And that's what eminent domain does, is it takes private citizens' property. Now, we can argue over how secure a border needs to be and how to go about it. But when you begin the argument with, we need to forcefully take somebody's stuff, that is not a good foundation to start with.
Let me ask you this. In the settling of America, do you think that eminent domain should have been prohibited?
Do I think prohibited?
Yeah, you're building a railroad that's running, let's just say, from New York to California, and there's a group of people in the way who have homes, and they don't want to sell, and they don't want to sell at any price. What do you think should happen?
I believe all alternatives should be considered, and if it's ruled that there's no other way to do it but that, and it's in a national security, then I'd say yes. But the problem is the argument has become more about, I want a wall to feel good about seeing a wall, rather than I want to make sure my border is secure.
I'm in the second camp. Okay, let's keep going.
I'm Bill Evers. I wondered if you would say something about Professor Jeffrey Hart of Dartmouth, who just died, and I believe was a mentor of yours. And I think people here, particularly students, would be interested in your experience.
The question is about dear and influential professor of mine, Jeff Hart, who was a deputy of Bill Buckley's at National Review. He was a very interesting character because actually in his later years, he became a leftist. He became a Democrat, he became a champion of Obama, and yet he has a whole generation of Dartmouth students who are conservative, spread out in all kinds of industries that he shaped and influenced. And so it's actually been for us very sort of bittersweet to watch, you may say, the evolution of Jeffrey Hart. In his later years, I would have these knockdown debate arguments with him about Obama. He would say things like, Dinesh, you have to admit, Bush was a complete idiot, and Obama is a genuine constitutional scholar. And I said, Jeff, Obama, who is a smart guy, don't get me wrong, but has never published a scholarly article on the Constitution or any other subject in any scholarly journal in his life. And he'd be like, what about the book Reading Obama by this guy Kloppenberg? I'm like, go read that book. This is an example of fake history. So this Kloppenberg is a Harvard historian. Kloppenberg will quote Obama saying things like, I'm a pragmatist. And then from that phrase, Kloppenberg goes, pragmatism, C.S. Pierce, William James, the early 20th century pragmatist, debating the nature of truth. Here's Obama saying the truth itself is up for grabs. Obama's saying none of the above. He's probably never heard of Pierce. He's probably barely heard of William James. This is like the movie with Chance the Gardener. You take pedestrian statements, infuse meaning into them, and declare the guy to be the smartest guy since Oliver Wendell Holmes. I mean, this to me is intellectual sleight of hand. It's embarrassing. Now, Hart was well into his 80s when we had these debates. When I was 17 years old, I thought of conservatives as really boring people who had toothbrush mustaches and walked around with umbrellas. And I thought, I don't want to be that. And then when I met Jeffrey Hart, this was a guy who had played in the US Open. This was a guy who was colorful, outrageous, comical, one of the few people who could make you laugh out loud, and was genuinely interested in ideas. He showed me a whole world of books and ideas I'd never heard of. I was a kid off the boat, you might say, from India. And I thought to myself, here's a whole world of knowledge, and here's a whole set of answers, and I didn't even know they were questions. So it was very important to my intellectual development to be exposed to that. And I came to understand, people said, well, Dinesh, when did you convert? When did you become a conservative? And it occurred to me, I never did. It was more like I immersed myself in conservative ideas, and I recognized that I'd always been a conservative. It was more a form of awakening than it was a conversion from one thing to another. And I think this is, by the way, true of most Asian Americans. We are conservative in our bones, and conservatism is a reflection of the things we already know and the way we already live. It merely articulates those ideas.
You made the argument that Democrats are the party of racism and slavery, and I will concede that it's true that Democrats in the 1880s were Democrats that perpetuated slavery. But I need to ask, how do you think through that lens when you look at the Southern strategy and you look at the fact that it was a Democratic president who put the Civil Rights Act into law, and afterwards it was Republicans who perpetuated the Southern strategy to try to make African Americans not vote?
The question is about the fact that, yes, the Democrats may be the party of slavery and racism. I think you then said something that was unfair, which is you said, I'll grant you in the 1880s, let's remember that the Ku Klux Klan was revived in the early 20th century. The lynchings and hangings that we identify with the Klan all occurred, a lot of them occurred in the teens and 20s. And the opposition to the civil rights was in the 60s. Now, with the solitary exception of, yes, Lyndon Johnson pushed the Civil Rights Act. True. And this is a longer story, which I won't be able to do justice to here, but why did he do it? Why did he do it? My argument is the following. After World War II, the horrific evidence of the concentration camps and the racism of Hitler began to have a powerful effect worldwide. It drove anti-colonialism in the Third World, but it also drove a diminution of racism in the American South. Racism was dropping rapidly in the American South after 1945. Now, you have to realize this was a huge problem for the Democratic Party, because after the Civil War, the glue holding the Democratic Party together in the South was, in fact, white supremacy. And so for Lyndon Johnson, it's like, now what? We're actually losing our base. The key to Nixon's Southern strategy was to appeal to the non-racist whites in the urban South. Read about it, because this Southern strategy that you're describing is a myth. The actual Southern strategy was really simple. Many people in the South are moving away from, the South is changing from an agricultural society to an industrial society. Many Northerners are moving South to places like Tampa and Atlanta and Raleigh-Durham and Houston. And Nixon's strategy was, I'm not campaigning in the rural South. That's racist country. I'm going to leave that to the Democrats. I'm going to campaign in the urban South and win the Northern, the displaced Northerners and the non-racist Southerners. That was Nixon's Southern strategy. And the proof? Just go look at what Nixon actually won. He won the urban South. He lost the Deep South. In 1968, the Deep South went for George Wallace, not Richard Nixon. And so what we're dealing with here is an argument about history, but an argument that's very important because of the claim of the party switch, which I deny.
Hi, Dinesh. My name is Peter Quill. I want to thank you for coming here today, and want to thank Stanford CR for putting up this great event. I was elected to be the California Republicans' vice chair just 4 days ago at the convention. Thank you. Now, 4 days on the job, I still have this drive. I want to get up every day and pay back to the country that saved my family's lives 36 years ago. We immigrated from Taiwan here legally. It took me 24 years to become a citizen. My question to you is, what drives you every day to get up and speak the truth? And second question is, how can you help us to turn California red again?
Basically, what drives me is this. When people think of immigrants, they think of Horatio Alger's stories. People coming to America to make it good, earn money, become successful. In my own case, what America has meant to me is somewhat different. It is that America has been the place, and I think the only place, where I've been able to be the architect of my own future, in the driver's seat of my own life. So look at the kind of, you know, if I stayed in India, I would have become an engineer like my dad or a doctor like my uncle. I would have followed in footsteps and I would have my destiny given to me. The beauty for me of America is it's a place where your destiny is constructed by you. And that to me is the promise of America. I don't think I would have gotten it anywhere else. And so when people ask, you know, what are your politics based on? My politics is based on fighting to preserve that American dream, which is uniquely American. I mean, frankly, there is no Chinese dream. There is no, I mean, if the French have a dream, I don't think we want to know. How do we turn California around? Just one brief thought. I do think it's a mistake for conservatives to say things like this. Young people are going to be left-wing when they're young, and then when they get older and really cynical like the rest of us and start paying taxes, they're going to become Republicans. There is an actually very healthy idealism in young people, and I would recommend that we tap into that. We appeal to that. We build on that. Conservatism, ultimately, what are we conserving? We're conserving the idealism of the American founding. So help to implant those principles in young people, and they're going to be just fine in the future.
Hi, so if the Democratic Party supporting slavery in the 19th century means the Democratic Party today is racist, so does that mean that Karl Marx and Engels writing for the New York Tribune, Horace Greeley's Republican newspaper in the 1860s, does that mean the Republican Party is the party of socialism today?
We have here an exercise in reasoning that needs to be put into slow motion to be dissected. Okay, so the reasoning is the following. First, you're contending that I contend that because the Democratic Party was the party of slavery before the Civil War, therefore, the Democratic Party is racist today. I would submit that I have made no such argument here tonight. For anyone listening fairly, my argument was that the party of slavery prior to the Civil War metamorphosed into the party of racism after the Civil War. And this racism carried well into the 20th century. In fact, when we talk about things like the Klan, it's always amusing to me. People go, well, what about David Duke? This is the precise type of counterexample intended to mislead. Because if you fairly were to say, let me really look at the topic. Let me make a list of all the Ku Klux Klan leaders, every Grand Dragon and Grand Kleagle, going back to the 1870s to now. And let's just put an R or a D after their name, 99% of them would be Democrats. That's a fact. The idea of David Duke is a false flag intended to camouflage attention and prevent a legitimate generalization from being made. Now, so the Democratic Party isn't the party of racism because of what happened before slavery. The Democratic Party self-consciously embraced racism after slavery. Lyndon Johnson, this is a very good example, because Lyndon Johnson is supposed to be a metaphor for the whole Democratic Party. Yeah, he was kind of a racist in his old Texas country boy days, the narrative goes, but then he became a marvelous, morally enlightened person and championed the Civil Rights Act. I would submit that if you read anything about Lyndon Johnson, you will see that this is a flat-out lie. The fact of the matter is that Lyndon Johnson was routinely using the N-word after the Civil Rights Act. And there is multiple examples of this from Robert Caro, from Doris Kearns Goodwin, from Lyndon Johnson's own driver. This is corroborated, it's attested, it's indisputable, and yet it is pushed under the rug by progressive historians who need the fake narrative. The fake narrative is the narrative of conversion. There was no conversion. Lyndon Johnson, once a bigot, always a bigot. So now a more interesting question emerges. Why would a bigot promote the Civil Rights Act of 1964? And I would submit that the reason for that is that the bigot realized, I can't cash in on white racism anymore. I've got to create a new type of dependent class of people who are now going to have to vote for me, and the very people I've been kicking around. Just listen to Lyndon Johnson's famous Howard University speech, a beautiful example of outright deception. Here's Johnson. He goes, You can't take a man who has been hobbled for decades and bring him up to the starting line and tell him to run on his own. And now I ask you, what is omitted from this moving sentence? What is omitted from this moving sentence? Who the hell has been hobbling this guy for decades, if not you? If not you? So if you, Lyndon Johnson, take 1 ounce of moral responsibility and say, I did it, and now I am willing to pay a price to set it right, but the deceitful bigot could not admit that. Even then, he was playing the same game that is played to now, which is let's blame it on somebody else. You cannot take a man who has been hobbled. Let's move into the convenient passive voice, as if somebody else did it. I'm here to fix it. I'm Lyndon Johnson. So history involves reading a little between the lines, recognizing that just as we have fake news, we have fake history, we have fake scholarship, you're smart enough here to know this and to be able to do this kind of reading, and it's very liberating. When you do it, it's very liberating. Okay, next question.
I think your response to that last question is definitely helpful in recognizing that some facts may be misleading, such as if I were to come up and give a lecture on Karl Marx and the history of communism in the Republican Party. Obviously, we can cherry-pick facts. And so I want to bring up this concern I have with some of your crushing facts, right? In that when you state just one small fact without contextualizing it, you run the risk of being counter to the generalization, which obviously my friend's fact was, right?
Agree completely.
And so I have a couple of facts that I think can help round out the picture. So one here, in response to the Southern strategy question, this is a quote from Kevin Phillips, Nixon's political strategist.
Yes.
It says, "The more Negroes who register as Democrats in the South, the sooner the Negrophobe whites will quit the Democrats and become Republicans. That is where the votes are. Without prodding from blacks, the whites will backside into their old, comfortable arrangement with local Democrats," right? So he's making the argument that we need the votes from the Negrophobe whites, not from the urban whites, as you suggested. And that's coming from Nixon's campaign manager. Secondly, data on support for the Civil Rights Act. In the South, 7% of Democrats in Congress supported the Civil Rights Act, and 0% of Republicans did. And in the North, 96% of Democrats and 84% of Republicans supported the Civil Rights Act. That fact, to me, seems like this was not a party issue, but a geography issue, in that very few people in the South supported the Civil Rights Act, and the vast majority of Northerners in both parties did. So then, the fact that right now the South is strongly Republican, and prior to the Civil Rights Act, the South was prominently Democrat, suggests to me that the party representation has switched to match that geographical preference.
Excellent question. And I will try to do justice because you've raised a lot of points. Let's start with Kevin Phillips. You need to pick up Kevin Phillips's book, The Emerging Republican Majority. You describe Kevin Phillips as Nixon's campaign manager, which he was not. Second of all, Kevin Phillips says very clearly on the first page, you are going to get from me an analysis of voting patterns in America. It is not a description of anything that Nixon did. In fact, Kevin Phillips says, Nixon has not seen any of my work. I'm writing it after the election. So Phillips makes it really clear that he is not the architect of anything. He is rather interpreting in his own way. And you have to remember, Kevin Phillips is a guy who swung from one side to the other of the political pendulum. So you've got a character who's mercurial in his judgments and has said the opposite things at different times. Nevertheless, let's move on to the larger point, which is, according to you, this party division is a geographical and not a partisan divide. And the technique you're using to demonstrate this is, you could call it controlling for region. Controlling for region, you're saying, the discrepancy between the parties at least diminishes, even if it doesn't go away altogether. The problem with the controlling for region is that you cannot control for something when the party itself is pushing to achieve that regional phenomenon. Let me tell you what I mean. We think today of the South as being the racist side of the country. C. Van Woodward tells us, the Yale historian, that after the Civil War, in the early 20th century and in the late 19th century, when the segregation debate, he goes, there was massive opposition to segregation in the South, in the South. He goes, this emergence of a Southern racist party, he says, was not foreordained. It was not the automatic result of the war. He goes, don't confuse slavery with racism. They're related, but they're not the same thing. Hold on, let me finish. The point I want to make is this. The Democratic Party cultivated the bigotry in the South that became a Southern phenomenon. So you can't now say, well, let's control for Southernness and take it all out and excuse all the Democrats because they're just being good old Southerners. I'm saying no. I'm saying that the Democrats polluted the South with a racist ideology and drove the Republicans out of the South. This was the whole point of the Ku Klux Klan. Racial terrorism was aimed at crushing the black Republican Party in the South. So you can't control for these things. The Democratic Party had its base in the South and it was a racist base. The Republican Party has its base in the North and it was a non-racist base. So now we turn to your last point, which is the most tempting of all. Gee, Dinesh, the South used to be Democratic through most of the 20th century. It's now Republican. Big switch. No. The key question here, I agree, I would add to your switch. Blacks who used to be Republicans are now Democrats. Big switch. The key question when you see these switches is to ask this question, when did the switch occur? So for blacks, let me tell you, the switch occurred in the 1930s. In 1932, 75% of blacks voted for Herbert Hoover. In 1936, 75% of blacks voted for FDR. Blacks switched into the Democratic Party having nothing to do with the civil rights movement and nothing to do with racism because the Democratic Party at that time was openly the party of segregation and the Ku Klux Klan. It was the economic benefits of the New Deal. That's a fact. The other fact is that the South moved into the Republican Party under Reagan and in the 90s under Gingrich. So what was the Reagan agenda? Now this I know from being up close. The Reagan agenda was patriotism, anti-communism, free markets, family values, pro-life, Christianity. Now, a very appealing agenda to a lot of Southerners. This was a continuation of the strategy of appealing to the non-racist South. So here's the beauty of it. If you want to be empirical, step back and draw two lines. The line of Southern racism, which you'll notice in the 20th century, is going like this, down ever since World War II. And the line of Southern republicanism, which is going like this, in the other direction. So as the South becomes less and less racist, it becomes more and more Republican. Okay, let's try another question.
This is going to be the final question of the night, so I'm going to apologize to everybody currently on the line. Sorry.
Okay, so I just, this is kind of a question more of like clarification about something that you said. I'm interested in hearing you expand on this following statement. To paraphrase, you highlighted the fact that you are a man of Indian descent and your wife is a woman of Mexican and Venezuelan descent, implying it's impossible or at least highly unlikely that you are or could be racist. I'm concerned you use your Indian heritage as a diversity card to shield yourself from criticism about racially or ethnically problematic comments and or stances that you've made or taken in the past. Is this not opposite but parallel to the stereotype that all people who are white are racist? A claim I don't agree with, and one that I'll concede some of the leftists you disagree with do employ for their purposes. I just kind of want to hear your thoughts on that, hear you expand on that.
I think I'm familiar with the view, but I don't share it, that people of color intrinsically cannot be racist. This is actually a doctrine of the left. And I don't agree with it because I think that racism is a doctrine of racial superiority, inferiority, of racial denigration. So obviously, in principle, it's possible for anyone to be a racist. Now, that being said, we always have to balance what someone says with a contextual use of what they said and with a fair attribution of the label. Because I think you would agree that if you go around calling people racist, just because they say things you don't agree with, or they have a disputed interpretation of something that on, let's just take a topic, let's just take, for example, slavery or a topic like that. Open debate is not racist. Open debate is very healthy in an academic community. Racial denigration is racist. So I ask you in fairness, I've been up here now speaking. If you believe the posters and the dissenters and the comments and the Stanford paper and so on, you might have expected me to stand up and give you 45 minutes of racial invective. So a very good way to test these things is to ask you, have you heard me say anything tonight that you would consider racist? And if not, why would you even raise that term in my connection?
Okay, there we go. So I will concede to you, I did not hear anything explicitly racist, and I do have to say I appreciate that. Thank you. However, just looking at some of the tweets and some of the publications and comments you have made in the past, and I can't recall specifically some right now, and I realize that looks shady, and I apologize. If I had photographic memory, I would pull those up, but I don't. But yes, I do believe that I've seen some tweets and some publications and comments you've made that some could argue are racially charged, which is why I brought this question up. But no, I will concede that you didn't this tonight.
Let me address that for a minute, because this is a case where I think it is good to go to the heart of the matter. The example that is most frequently used in this context on social media occurred about a year ago when I released the movie Death of a Nation. Now, if you've seen this movie, the thrust of this movie, somewhat along the lines of my talk, is that the racism and the fascism, which I dramatize luridly in the movie, are actually the work of the left and, in America, of the Democratic Party. So in the heat of promoting this movie, I was flying around the country, and someone on the left decided to set a trap for me. And so what they did was they tweeted my movie trailer. Great movie, watch this movie. Hashtag bring back slavery. Right? Now, I looked at the person's account. It's a fake account. I wasn't accidentally retweeting a white supremacist, nothing like that. This was someone on the left who tried to trap me by putting the hashtag, knowing that in the craziness of movie promotion, doing 30 or 40 retweets a day, trying to promote my movie, I would retweet the trailer without seeing the hashtag. And that's what happened. I retweeted the trailer. Seconds later, it was pointed out to me, I deleted it. But the people who planted it were there to capture the image and then send it out everywhere. It resulted in me losing speaking engagements and so on. So let me ask you this. What's really insidious here? That I unwittingly and foolishly, but nevertheless, inadvertently, I mean, I've written 17 books. I couldn't be a scholar at the Hoover Institution if I really believe bring back slavery. No sane person in public life would do that. So to set me up and then use this to try to destroy my career by pretending people who knew better that they were trying to attribute to me something I never believed and would never do. So which is more dangerous, me accidentally doing the retweet or the evil people who were trying to destroy my career by smearing me with opinions that I don't hold? In all honesty, I'd ask you to think about that. And I also say to all of you, I really appreciate the, I expected this to be a stormier event, just given the way it was set up, but you've listened very attentively. The questions have actually been excellent. I appreciate the time. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.